This is Gemma Redgrave, and you're listening to Gallifrey Public Radio.
I'm Kevin, a.k.a. Neon Nazgul from the Operation Pug Podcast, a proud member of the Gunna Geek Network, just like the show you're listening to now. The opinions expressed are those of each individual host. Check out all the other podcasts at GunnaGeekNetwork.com and get ready, because geekiness begins in 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to Gallifrey Public Radio, a podcast dedicated to positive enjoyment of everything in the Doctor Who spectrum. Join us each week for discussions ranging from Hartnell to Whittaker and beyond. Your GPR hosts are Jay Witten.
Safety measures are for chumps who don't know what they're doing.
Kier Hansen.
Oh, hold on. I saw it on my mixer. I turned up the suck. Hold on.
And Haley Malley.
I feel like I might need to carb up for next week's episode.
Oh, and
spoilers.
We do discuss recent news, episodes that have already aired in their home territories, and the occasional interesting rumor. But don't worry, if we look too far into the future, we'll give you a fair warning. Welcome to episode 265 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where we find ourselves in the most uncomfortable place we could possibly imagine. No, it's not the Elizabeth Seaport exit off of I-95 in New Jersey, but it's the other really uncomfortable place. It's the spot between never wanting to let Peter Capaldi go and not wanting to wait another moment to welcome in Jodie Whittaker. Sometimes Christmas really, really hurts. My name is Kier.
I'm Jay.
And I'm Haley. This week, we take a break from taking a break and actually get a new episode of Doctor Who. And this one is no short story. In Twice Upon a Time, we mark the end of Peter's tenure as the 12th Doctor, the close of Stephen Moffat's era as a showrunner, and if you believe the rumors, as a Doctor Who screenwriter altogether. The last compositions of Murray Gold for the show, the last costume for Hayley Niebuhr, and, well, you get the idea. But just to ensure it's not a completely depressing event, we get a few rather unexpected Moffat holiday gifts, and the star on the tree, the dramatic arrival of our 13th Doctor.
Now, I know I've rewatched this about 3 times. Jay, I know you've got at least 2. How many total?
Actually, only 1.
What?
I wasn't
You're staying within the Christmas effect.
No, I literally, I wasn't able to watch it live last night, and so it was once I got home, and then I had to work today, so yeah.
All right. Haley, how about you? How many times did you get a chance to watch
it? I've seen it 2.5, because I watched it, the BBC broadcast without commercials, and then I tried to watch the BBC America broadcast with commercials, and it made me angry. So that was in and out. And then I watched it again today without commercials.
Gotcha. Okay. All right. Fair. All right. So Jay, you said you got a chance to watch it once before you turned in for the night last night.
Yeah.
Did anyone else dream about the episode? I was catching glimpses, little snippets of scenes that would keep revolving in my head on those moments where you're sort of just half awake.
I don't know if it was actual dreaming or if it was just stuff wandering through my head as I was drifting off to sleep. Okay. But yeah, it definitely kept fresh in my mind.
Yeah. Yeah. That it does, because there's just, as Haley alluded to, there's a lot packed into this. We're not really going to reference a lot of the comments that have been flying around about the episode from outside sources. We've had some listeners that have chimed in as well, just saying that they were, generally pleased with the episode, with a couple of little exceptions. No, it wasn't a perfect work, but, they really enjoyed it for XYZ. We may check into those. But as far as there are a handful of dissenters, there always are. So be it. Oh, yeah. Not really dissenting for the things I thought they would. They're actually kind of picking apart some of the things, like the way some of the classics were referenced and tied in and such. But those we're just going to kind of move past, because this is not really kind of the emphasis of our cast, but it's really not one of the things that we wanted to try to draw upon as far as a first blush impressions of this very momentous and milestone episode. I think it's only safe if we walk through this one a little chronologically. Kind of cool with that? Chronologically with a time travel show, but you know what I mean. As far as in order of airing.
Yes. Yeah, definitely. All right. I think that's a good idea.
So we knew from the close of the previous episode that we were going to have this interaction between 1st and 12th. The opportunity, Stephen Moffat was relishing the idea of being able to work with David Bradley as Bill Hartnell, and he had something really great in mind for something about the turn of the clock, if you will, from the first hour to the 12th hour, and the clock comes around again. So how do we feel about that kind of their exchanges, their interplay, and their behavior around one another? Did they stay true to themselves individually as they interacted, or was there some sort of meeting in the middle?
You know, I kind of felt that it was... They definitely played up some aspects of Hartnell's Doctor for comedic effect, or for to highlight stuff. There were parts of it that were exaggerated, but I feel like for the most part it was pretty spot on, and there was never a moment where I thought if the first Doctor and the 12th Doctor met, they would never act that way towards each other. Like, I felt like that, knowing the characters like I do, it felt like genuine interactions between the two of them.
Okay. Haley, how'd you take it?
Yeah, I loved every bit of interaction between these two Doctors. And even if they played up some of Bradley's portrayal a little bit, it worked so well with the way it was playing off of the 12th Doctor that I didn't care.
Yeah, I kind of felt it was justified to the most part, or for the most part. Jay, I agree that there were some things that they tried they leaned hard in on a little bit, because they really wanted to establish the fact that, and I think this is really kind of a message that has been kind of conveyed, that the Doctor has evolved. The program has evolved. Society has evolved. Therefore, we're kind of hoping that the fan base evolves as well. And you can either choose a role with it, or you can get kind of, you know, left in the cave, so to speak. But yeah, I guess I can kind of understand some people that said, wow, they were really kind of painting it an inch thick, you know, or they were sort of, you know, building up from, you know, a couple of remarks that that Hartnell had actually made, because he was a product of his time, and that sort of thing was just considered to be a little bit more of a well, this is just a gentleman's way of speaking, or what have you. And these days we say, you know, we put that in quotes around locker room talk, and it's completely unacceptable. And I think... Right. That's one of the reasons why it was left in there as such a stark contrast. You know, 12 just jumping all over. Can we please just stop? No, look over here, flashing lights. Oh, you know, anything you could possibly do to just get this, to keep him from rolling with any of those sort of statements, because he has bettered himself. Quite a bit of that, I think one of the greatest leaps in that, thanks to Bill. I mean, I'm so glad that she was the character to have in the room to make him, to make 12, so uncomfortable at having any sort of light shed on his less than stellar past.
Yeah. I think one of the great moments was when the first Doctor and the, we'll refer to him as the captain for now.
Yeah.
When they were, you know, making the comments about, you know, women made of glass and that kind of thing. And the Doctor's like, I know a thing or two about women. And Bill's instant response was just, yeah, me too. And I mean, that's all it took.
Yeah. Oh, and they let that scene hang for that couple of extra seconds while the two of them just kind of blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
Loved it. I mean, as far as Bradley's performance, I guess I would probably say in retrospect, I mean, from everything we've seen from Adventures in Space and Time and so forth, I think he, and I mean this with as much respect as I can possibly convey, I think he does a far more admirable job of portraying William Hartnell than he may the first Doctor, if that makes any sense.
You know, I think I kind of agree with you. I was thinking the same thing, but I think part of that is simply because we know the first Doctor so much better than we did William Hartnell. I mean, yeah, it's, we spent how much time admiring the first Doctor and just watching that kind of thing. With Bill Hartnell, it was more a, you know, this is what, you know, things have reported on or whatever, and it wasn't a firsthand experience for us, so
we're more willing to accept that and say, oh, that must be
exactly, yeah. Whereas with the first Doctor, it's like, that's a character we know and love, that's somebody we've paid attention to and know about, you know, the behavior and
oh, but even down to things like his speech patterns, you know, where does he take the pauses or where does he kind of run his lines faster? Mm-hmm. Or moments where in the middle of a line, he'll stop and, you know, scratch his chin and think about, you know, these kind of pensive things. And a lot of that was the fact that Hartnell was, well, searching for lines. I mean, doing yeah. this practically live takes. So, or if he would roll back on a line a bit and start the sentence over again because he was taking another running pass at it. But that was, it became part of the First Doctor's persona, and Bradley's representation, everything was clipped tight, it was, you know, well rehearsed, it didn't have any of that, none of that existed.
Yeah.
So polished, I guess.
Yeah, and that was one of the things, like, it did feel like he was much more coherent than the First Doctor typically tended to be, but,
yeah.
Honestly, the only problem while I was watching, it didn't bother me. It was only in retrospect that I went back and started thinking about it. I'm like, that felt kind of off. But the only thing that while I was watching that really pulled me out of it, was the changeover from William Hartnell to David Bradley. It reminded me of one of those horrible, like, morphing videos that were real big when the technology first hit.
Yeah.
And it's just, it took me a few seconds to be like, whoa, okay. Put down the nausea. Let's just, I can move forward from here. But I mean, after that, I was pretty much set.
Okay. All right. And Haley, you went through all the.
Well, and they kind of gave us, sorry.
No, I was going to say, you went through all the First Doctor rewatches with us. So you've gotten, you know, pretty well versed on how you kind of feel he's been represented historically.
Yeah. They kind of gave us an out for it, like a little bit of in-universe justification is he's in the state of grace where he has, right. you know, turned down the regeneration for a while, so that is affecting how he is able to interact. Is, you know, maybe he's a little more coherent than he was towards the end of this regeneration because he's got that little extra regeneration boost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had picked up on the same thing. I kind of marked it as, okay, we're getting a chance to see him at full strength for a very limited amount of time, you know, because Capaldi was stumbling around, you know, on multiple occasions in the last few episodes, completely weak at the knees and, you know, or as he said, weak as a kitten, but then gets this moment to be able to kind of hold everything together as they're trying to stave off a regeneration that they have this choice. You know, well, that's it, you know, either we change and go on or we die as we are. Reference Bill as being this catalyst for a lot of the, or sort of an amplification of the Doctor's advances as far as going from, think about where we met him, you know, think about Deep Breath and the mm-hmm. gruff 12th Doctor, you know, this acerbic, practically Malcolm Tucker, you know, kind of, you know, pudding brains and so forth. And now he's making long speeches about the value of kindness and moments of peace.
Well, nothing was able to portray that quite as well as just the interaction at the very end. When, I mean, you think about the end of Deep Breath. What's the first thing that he does is Clara goes to give him a hug. And he's like, no, don't back off. And then the last time we see him with Bill and Nardal, I mean, he's saying goodbye to him. And he's the one that initiates the hug. Mm-hmm. It's beautiful.
You mean the cuddles. But as far as Bill, how do we feel? All right, and this is kind of a two-part here because this kind of leads into this whole treatment of this testimony. You know, Moffat trying to come up with one last ace up his sleeve to say, look, I can still create interesting characters and dynamics too, and comes up with this idea of Bill, who isn't Bill, but kind of is Bill, but isn't physically Bill. But it's as much Bill as you need.
Right.
This doesn't, in my mind, fall under the Moffat doesn't understand death motif so much as Moffat really loves his characters and wants to give them a chance to have the send-off with, wants everybody to have a closing monologue.
Yeah. I liked it. I thought that it was an interesting, it was a great way to play up the aspect of memory, because especially in a regeneration episode, when you have the Doctor becoming an entirely new person, and you know, it could almost be seen as a way of staving off the the critics about a female doctor saying, yes, this is a new person, but they retain all their memories. And so it is still fundamentally the doctor, you know, and it just playing up that aspect of it in a regeneration episode. I don't feel like that was an accident.
Okay. Haley, how did this sit with you? The whole idea of bringing Bill back, but then to kind of taking away the whole Bill. This is what I kept stumbling over, and I'm still not sure I totally understand because of the way the testimony works. They've been around since 5 billion and 12, just to pick a number. Mm-hmm. And they've been working their way backward through time, grabbing people at the moment of their death to get a snapshot, sort of a backup drive of all of their memories, and then put them back into their time and place so they can die naturally with no memory of anything that's happened. And so they've got this beautiful archive of everybody, everywhere, and everything they've thought until seconds before their death. What an amazing backup system they've got. Better than the library. Oh, wait, he's done that already. But does that mean that if they've got Bill on file, at least by 5 billion AD, they've got Bill on file, so Bill did die because if the testimony's got her backed up,
mm-hmm.
then she didn't live forever with Heather.
No.
Not forever, but she died at some point, I guess?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of what it was saying from what I understood was that it was just at some point she did wind up dying and... But she had a great run with Heather in the process.
That she doesn't seem to really have a whole lot of cognizance of.
Or she's just not sharing it with the doctor.
Okay. I guess I can kind of blur that one out and not worry about it too much. Because at least as far as her recollection, as far as a representative manifestation of everything that was Bill. If you don't believe in the soul and you believe that, wow, we're getting into the metaphysical here. if you believe the soul is just the culmination of your memories and the impact that you leave upon the world, then for all intents and purposes, this was Bill, and which is why she reacts as she does. She still comes to conclusions. She's still asking questions. She's still learning because that's what Bill does. But she keeps flipping back and forth to being the testimony glass avatar as we get later into the episode. So it's difficult to tell when we're dealing with Bill being put out as the active avatar and interacting and learning and reacting and so forth and having exchanges. And then the testimony stepping in and saying, no, all right, let's pull that back because we have something we need to say. Or has it been happening in duality all along? And the testimony just kind of sits behind the surface. That got a little smeary.
It was very much like Bill's going to be Bill right now because that's what we need. And now Bill's going to be the testimony because plot.
Okay. So they just shell for a second or they pause the Bill playback.
Yeah. And that's
unfortunately, I saw it more as Bill acting as an agent for this testimony. Like, how would Bill go about doing this, getting the information we need?
Okay.
Well, I mean, and
she thought she was Bill for a while. Couldn't remember how she got there. Adamantly defending the fact that she was, I don't know.
But even at the end, she was saying, "I am Bill because I am Bill's memories. I am Bill."
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, it seemed like it was, I don't know, I mean, it executed roughly at first because they needed it to be, a mystery until the end. But then, like, once she was revealed, it was kind of like, okay, she's working along, it's like, she understands that she's part of the testimony, and she understands what they need from the doctor. They need to understand this, that, and the other. So it was kind of like she was working towards those ends, but knew that the doctor didn't trust her, so she was playing the part of Bill... like naively playing Bill or what? I don't know. It could have been written a little bit more cleanly, but Moffat wanted that mystery there.
Yeah. Did you guys, I love that we got Bill again. I adore Bill,
mm-hmm.
but did you guys feel like Susan would have been the better choice to be in that role?
I seriously thought it was going to be.
Yeah. Were you the first, were you among that too? When you saw the silhouette in the doorway?
I mean, my first instant reaction was, I thought that it was going to be River, but then once you actually started to see an outline, I'm like, no, wait, River would be stupid. They're going to do Susan. And yeah,
there were a lot of people that actually expected to see Carol Ann Ford walk through the door.
You know, it would have been the perfect excuse to do it because you had the first doctor there.
Yeah.
So
Because the first Doctor is missing his granddaughter at this point as well. So for both of them to be in that position and both of them have the opportunity to see her again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have a feeling that there was, and I'm willing, if the day ever comes, like I get a chance to sit across a table with Mr. Moffat and ask, this will be probably one of my only questions is how many times did you go back and delete the line Susan enters from any episode you've ever written? Because I am willing to bet that there have been multiple occasions where he has wanted to make that happen and has just decided that it just wasn't the right place for it.
And we know how much Capaldi wanted that too.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So did Carol Ann. she said as much. But I think they needed to get Bill in there because Bill is 12's best friend. And and he deserved and she deserved to see each other through the final hours. I think there are very few people I think he could really have the cognizance to want to turn to say that in these moments of I need a little bit of additional guidance here. If you're Bill Potts, what would Bill Potts do? Only to have her say, I sit back and let you do what you're going to do anyway.
Yeah. You know? That was great, though. I love that line.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sir, and I mean, that was very much Bill. There were moments where it was just like, when the first Doctor said, oh, that, or she said something about what are you running away from? Or what were you running to?
Yeah.
And he's like, oh, that was a good question. She's like, yeah, questions are kind of my thing.
That's it.
That's Bill.
That is. And we knew that from the pilot, that she was just that right amount of curiosity. Some of it was just because she really needed to know because she felt like she was, you know, in danger for whatever. But a lot of it was just because she had this kind of open-eyed, sure. What's this? What's that? Who's that guy? you just adore that about her.
Yeah.
Speaking of returned characters.
Yes.
What? All right. You got a problem with Rusty?
No, I was thrilled. Like the moment that the first Dalek jumped on the captain's face.
Yep.
I was like, oh, it's Daleks. And I couldn't decide up until the very end if it was going to be Davros or Rusty. And it wasn't until he like popped around the corner and said, I forget what his line was at that moment, but.
No one could have believed there could be such a thing as a good Dalek.
Yeah, it was right before he said that. I was like, no, it's going to be Rusty. They're going to tie that up. And then he says that, and I'm like, yeah, that's it.
I think that's about the time where I figured it out.
I was only seconds before you when they said that they couldn't believe that one of you would turn against his own kind.
Like, yeah, I think that's where it started. Yeah.
But I don't take any points for that because it still was one of those things where I had no idea who was up in the watchtower. Trying to kill him until the moment he was scanned. And yet still wanted to kill him. You know, the relationship.
Just because he hates the Doctor doesn't mean that he isn't still a Dalek. Or just because he hates all other Daleks doesn't mean that, you know, it's not deep-seated, you know, hatred of the Doctor.
The enemy of my enemy is not always my friend.
Exactly,
sometimes you're still a jerk. But no, I think that was as far as a mechanism of having to tap into a larger data resource... Yeah, the Dalek hive mind is one of the biggest you could possibly tap into. I thought that was a clever convention. I don't really understand why he's hiding at the center of the universe. I thought that was just a little bit of a interesting. I just wanted to write something cool.
Yeah, I did like the name check about the Matrix on Gallifrey.
Yeah,
I got kind of excited about that, but I like the way that it played out.
Yeah. There was all kinds of interesting things they were throwing around. There were a lot of times where this was Moffat really saying, I'm going to pull out all the stops, you know, and show you that, like, the Doctor has many names bit that the testimony pulls out. And you're like, okay, the destroyer of the world. All right, what does that mean? The imp of the Pandorica. Yeah, okay, easy, I got that one. Shadow of the Valyard. Ooh,
yes.
That's an interesting one to chew on. Because if he's the shadow of the Valyard, then that means the Valyard is the one that stands tall. Oh, okay. Or you can play with that one all day long. The Beast of Trenzalore. Okay.
Right.
Sure. Got that. That's fine. The Butcher of Skull Moon.
That's
a fun one to play with. That's going to have a lot of people going back and trying to find out what all the references are to pull that one together. The Last Tree of Garsenon. I'm not even sure I get that one, so I'm going to defer to some of my Uber nerds to help me on that one. And the Destroyer of Skaro, culminating into the Doctor of War. This may be one of the only things with this episode that I'm not really sure that I liked that Moffat was doing with characters and with phrases that he has worked into the vernacular. The War Doctor. Now we've got the Doctor of War. And he's still playing that, you know, spinning that Rubik's Cube around. I'm not really sure that I liked it because I love the way it was resolved at the end when they say, you know, this is the Doctor of War. War hurts. Mm-hmm. This is your doctor, you know, that, and that kind of thing. But it felt that flip was really kind of clunky to me. Because it doesn't even reference, I mean, if they know the Doctor so well, then they would have known the fact that he put his name aside when he became the Warrior. And that was a very conscious choice and a very difficult choice for him and a difficult road back. If they are as wise and all-knowing as they claim to be after 5 billion and 12 years.
To be fair, they took out all the jokes.
They did. They left out all the jokes.
That was a great line, though. I did like that.
It was a good line. I felt those effects of having all of the iterations floating around in the bubbles was a little difficult to follow because of everything. I mean, orchestra swelling, testimony is droning on and on and on and on with that litany of names. And you've got these little tiny balls floating around to look and say, oh, okay, all right, there's Pertwee. Oh, okay, there's McCoy. Oh. Mm-hmm. Just barely make out certain ones. In fact, a lot of the classics were really kind of hard to discern altogether, but you got Tennant real clear.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's Tennant.
But just the same. All right, we're still talking about returning characters here. The restoration of his memories of Clara.
I like that. Oh,
I loved it. And I'm kind of surprised that I loved it so much because, well, now we've got a pattern. So apparently anytime a doctor regenerates, he's going to get all of his companions back at that point.
Yeah.
I mean, you think about the multi, you know, with everybody with it at the end of Tenet, you know, then with 11, he got to see Amy again. Now we've gotten Clara returning. So apparently this is just something we're going to do.
Yeah.
But I feel like this was executed much more smoothly than having Amy show back up.
Yes. I absolutely agree. Haley.
Well, and because they didn't set Bill aside to bring Clara back.
Yeah.
Which they kind of did with Tennant and Clara and Amy.
I love the fact that Bill was the one to articulate to a certain degree, because this was, I think if anybody could understand that in the doctor companion relationship, or as she calls this kind of, you know, teacher or this professor student thing that we've got going on here, that there are other people in the doctor's life. You know, she's witnessed it, she understands it, and she kind of understands everybody's sort of place in things, that I don't think it would be any sort of a personal affront to her to know, okay, there's been other people that have traveled with you before, and they all mean something to you. I've come to know, as a result of my memories being added to all of that of the testimony, that there is a companion that you have not been allowed to remember. And I can't imagine how upset you would be if you actually knew that was being kept from you. So we give you this back. That alone made it okay for me. I think if it was anything close to, Haley, to what you're saying about the whole Amy Pond walking in, you know, oh, my silly raggedy man, let me fix your tie. No, I would have smashed the screen there and then.
Yeah.
Because that's gratuitous. I didn't like it when they did it in the 50th. I wouldn't have liked it now. But this had purpose. And I think it was not only I don't think it was only beneficial to the character. I think it was a nice reflection on something that gave the Doctor a bit of closure for himself. Mm-hmm. But in keeping with the theme that we've established through this whole season, it was kind. You know, that's a gesture of kindness. And I think that was high praise.
And that was kind of the thing that I appreciated about it. It wasn't just a an excuse to get Clara back in there. Like it made sense for the story they were telling. It made sense for the doctor. You know, it's just it worked on so many levels. So
yeah,
it helps going forward too, because now the next doctor will remember Clara.
Yeah,
right. Yeah,
yeah. I can't imagine. I mean, it's it's almost as if you were to allow future regenerations to occur and adventures to continue and similar situations. Can you imagine if there was any sort of a similar situation in a future episode where dealing with the same sort of anything that the Doctor had experienced when traveling with Clara, and all of a sudden the Doctor can't tap into those resources or can't utilize that sort of a, well, I've been here before, because she can't remember somebody who was that important to her in the past. I think that's robbing a character of something that I'm glad that they've gotten back. And again, I really love the fact that it was Bill that sort of officially handed that back as the little Christmas present that was better than the rug, because seriously, he hated the rug. All right, one last little way reveal, and a lot of people had kind of cottoned on to this from the moment they saw a crappy mustache on Mark Gatiss, and that was the captain's identity. I'm not going to say a word.
I liked the way that it was executed. I felt like it wasn't, I mean, it was obligatory, but it wasn't overly done. Like, they weren't playing it up for anything. It was just kind of like, hey, here's a nice throwback. You know, it didn't play anything into the plot. It didn't, he wasn't trying to make this character bigger or more important than he should have been. Mm-hmm. It was just kind of a, you know, your life goes through and touches so many different people, and, you know,
yeah,
I think it worked.
Skywalker family there and everything. Haley, how did you react to that final reveal?
I liked it. I don't have as much of an attachment to the brig as you two do, obviously, but I very much enjoyed, like, you know, the Lethbridge-Stewart family has been a huge part of the Doctor from even the first iteration. Now it's canon. They've said it. It's true.
Yeah.
So I enjoyed it very much.
Their name has been hyphenated since at least the turn of the 20th century. So who knows where that family lineage came from.
They created the hyphenated name.
Exactly, exactly. It really was just one big long word, Leopard Sword. I will say that one of the reasons why this sat so well with me was I think this was, again, a question I'll ask if I ever get the opportunity. This was an apology for the cyber brig. That's the only way, you know, I see it. I think he realizes that was probably a bit of a that was a bit of a bold step, especially because he left him floating around in orbit.
I can definitely see that. I can see that. This one was handled with a bit of reverence, and because they gave the character such a high moral standard. Like, I mean, the moment where he's like, you know, it sounds to me like they're trying to give you this girl for my life, and seeing his mind's just about done, mm-hmm. I've got no problem sacrificing myself. And he said it in such a calm, like, yeah. He had thought this through. It wasn't a spur of the moment kind of thing. He's like, no, I'm totally okay with this.
Yeah. You know?
And that's something that you would expect an ancestor of the brig, somebody that raised the brig himself. That's what you would expect from him. So mm-hmm. I thought that it was really well done.
I also love the fact that through, you could tell that he had a lot of Lethbridge Stewart in him throughout, because there's all those moments where he says, I'm slightly slipping out of context here, not really gathering. His best exchange was, one imagines some of those words were attached to actual meanings of some sort.
Yes.
That's so Lethbridge Stewart.
It was. It was so very much. I loved it. And I mean, honestly, I absolutely adored Gatiss in the role too. I thought he did a spectacular job with it. He was brilliant.
Yeah, he can come act on Doctor Who anytime he wants.
Exactly.
Yep, without question. So now we get to the building up towards our apex here. We finally get an understanding of why we are on this battlefield in 1914. I cottoned onto it in the first couple scenes because I had actually just recently listened to a radio program where they were discussing, you know, it was Christmas season, and they like to talk about, you know, historical significance of the date throughout the years. And since we had just passed the 100th anniversary of it a few years prior, they were discussing this historic occurrence of the Christmas night peace accord, so to speak. May have been embellished a little bit for the sake of the script, but it was relatively accurate insofar as they put down their weapons, they tended to each other's wounded, they shared meals, they shared songs, they shared drinks, and went back to their respective trenches by dawn. But I knew from the first scenes as they were sort of establishing this that the fact that both TARDISes were materializing on the bank of that particular battlefield or that weird frozen, by the time they get him back to that kind of frozen moment, that this allowed me to remember, okay, this is a Christmas episode. Because I know as we were watching it as a family, there were a number of people that were saying, as we got about 40 minutes into the thing, they're like, isn't this a Christmas episode? This has absolutely nothing to do with Christmas. And I said, well, it will in a minute. Just hold tight.
Yeah. and you know, I started having that thought process too, because it was, I was waiting for the moment because, I mean, remember with, was it the return of Dr. Mysterio? It was just very much like a one-off, like, oh yeah, no, it's Christmas, and now let's tell the rest of the story. And so I was really hoping it wasn't going to take that turn. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, I know that this is a big deal. I know that there's a lot in this episode that we need to get through, but, you know, at least do more than just nod your head at the fact that it's Christmas. And I thought that that was great. Like, it didn't have to be all the way throughout. It wasn't robotic snowmen and spinning Christmas trees, but I thought that it was a good nod to the fact that, yes, this was a Christmas special.
Yeah. And it tees up the culmination and the closure, really, the absolute closure of the 12th Doctor's legacy, which is the idea that in the middle of the chaos, in the middle of the bloodshed, in the middle of all of these disparities, everybody stops and everyone is just kind. And it gives him that opportunity to deliver that speech, which, I mean, well, all that, even that is just the preamble to his farewell speech.
Yeah.
Which, if I don't see this tattooed on people within the next 2 years, I think somebody's really missing opportunities here. Because of all the speeches he's delivered, these are the ones where it really boils down. Maybe leave out the line about the pears if you want to, but all the rest. You know, well,
that's really important for the ribbon.
What the hell? Yeah, well, yeah, you need to save space. You can only fit so many characters. But I can't even... This is one of those ones where even seeing it written on the page, it's difficult to just pass through without really feeling it emotionally. This is Moffat at his finest in taking just the tiniest little seed of humor and wrapping it in a... You know, it's like what's that Douglas Adams reference? It's like being beaten to death with a gold brick wrapped in a slice of lemon. You know, that's a pangalactic gargle blaster, but it's just the same. It's the idea of you use that little bit of sugar to say, all right, I'm going to hand you something very sour. This is going to be very difficult. It's going to hurt you in the heart, but there's a little bit of sweetness to it. And, yeah. And like the recognition of children may be allowed. And this is, I wanted to ask you both about this one because I thought this is very kind of poignant. I'm wondering if this is kind of queuing something up that we may be able to explore later. That the Doctor withholding his name except for children, because children can hear it if their hearts are in the right place. That's a very Santa Claus-y kind of thing, you know. But what does that tell you about? I'm sure in his mind, Moffat has devised what he believes to be the true name of the Doctor. In his mind. But where do you think he's going with this?
I don't think that it was really that he was going anywhere with it. I think that it was more just kind of a thing where he understands it's important not to tell anyone the name of the Doctor. And that it's just kind of, you know, trying to cement it into the mythos that you never reveal the name of the Doctor. Mm-hmm. Just trying to protect the, you know, future showrunners from trying to do it. And as far as the thing with the kids, it's kind of, yeah, I mean, you always assume that there's like a magic to children. I mean, they understand things on a level that's, you know, adults just can't grasp anymore. I mean, what was the one quote about Doctor Who? It's, you know, you have to keep it complex enough for children, but simple enough for adults.
Yeah.
And I think that that's, it kind of ties into that.
Well, and also he's saying, you know, even if an adult heard it, they wouldn't understand it. Does this mean that River doesn't even really know the Doctor's name?
I don't think it's that she doesn't know it, but she doesn't understand its full meaning, perhaps.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Like, it's kind of like someone quoting the Magna Carta. Like, yeah, you might know the words, but you don't really understand what they mean anymore.
I've never heard them quite in that order before. Or yeah, it's like rattling off a string of numbers that someone might listen to and say, oh, that's a Fibonacci sequence. But someone else is just saying, all right, you're just running through a line of numbers. Okay, it's sure. That's nice. No, you don't see the significance? It's everywhere. It's everywhere. You can lay this over a picture of anything. But I think this pulls together. I think you could probably grab aspects of everything that Moffat has attempted. And we're going to do this. We'll have an episode devoted entirely towards the Moffat era, and we'll call it the Moffat agenda or something, or the Moffat impact. We'll come up with something catchy, probably involving alliteration. But I think a lot of what he packed into these final kind of closing statements for Capaldi, because these are really his closing statements as well. These are his closing statements. Mm-hmm. Last things he's writing for the Doctor, televised anyway.
Right.
He'll do a few novelizations, but the whole idea of, he goes back, he returns to the standards of never be cruel, never be cowardly. All right. Absolutely. Hate is always foolish. Love is always wise. Something that even the Doctor loses sight of from time to time. But I think that, specifically with 12, I think that's something that he had to remind himself.
Mm-hmm.
And it allowed us to infuse that back into the program again. You know, a lot of people that kind of wrinkled at Capaldi in his first season because, well, he's still so gruff. You know, I can't warm up to him. I just can't click with it and so forth. And I still have friends to this day who won't, who can't. They tried. They just don't. And maybe they'll come around eventually as a sense of completion, and they'll get rewarded. Maybe they won't. I don't know. But I think that's where we've ended up. I think he's come around to that realization about the always try to be nice but never fail to be kind, and the distinction between the two.
Yes, I absolutely loved that line. I thought it was fantastic because it can be two very different things, and understanding the importance of one over the other can make all the difference in the world.
Yeah. It just keeps repeating that over and over and over again. I mean, I think the word kind comes up in the script 6 or 7 times over mm-hmm. the course of this one, because he repeats it again when he says, you know, laugh hard, run fast. Well, this is the Doctor. And Capaldi, when he laughs hard, it's creepy. You know.
Yeah.
And be kind. And what it's interesting. Somebody was talking about last lines for Doctors Before Regeneration about the idea of their self-identification rather than their multi-identification. It's sort of like they pulled it upon like the tenants, I don't want to go.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you're not really going. It's only you, but not the capital U. It's just the lowercase. You know, it because in this one, he says, Doctor, I let you go.
Mm-hmm.
That one's complicated, and I'm not really sure about that last line. I'm still going to wrestle with that one for a while because it reminds me of things like, you know, putting the name of the Doctor aside kind of thing, or the I let you go, meaning, well, are we expecting something dramatically different as far as persona? Yes, I understand gender, sure, fine, but it's still the Doctor in there.
Right.
I still got to figure that one out.
It kind of makes me think of when, you know, you'll hear him say things like, I'll always remember when I was you, or
yeah.
something like
or
that.
When the Doctor was me, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I guess that's kind of, well, now we start getting into some sort of a Catholicism and Trinity, the 3-in-1 kind of stuff. Recognizing self as self and self as part of the greater identity. Kind of a complicated thing to write for. How do you choose your pronouns? I don't know. But yeah.
I to me, like when I heard that, the only thing I thought was that it was just the Doctor saying, like, I mean, he was prepared to die. He did not want to become anyone else. Like, this was his moment to say, you know, it's like, I'm so fond of who I am now that I don't want to be anyone else. I'm tired of being other people. And this was his moment of saying, you know what? There's more important things than just hanging on to this Doctor. So, Doctor, I'm going to let you go and move on to who I need to be now.
Maybe it has to do with the fact that, as you said, he was ready to be the last iteration and ready to accept death,
mm-hmm.
because he felt that he had done all that he possibly could, but then is reminded that while he feels at present that this man, this bloke, you know, as Bill says, standing on a hill there, trying to do all he can to hold the universe together, has accomplished everything that he feels he can. The Doctor is not done yet. So
yeah.
I, this go-around, let you, the doctor, go about doing your thing, continue to go and do all that you do, have done, and will continue to do for as long as the universe keeps calling and calling and calling. So maybe
well, it's and now that we're kind of sorry, now that we're kind of talking about that death of the doctor, so the testimony was taken at the end of the first doctor. So is that something they do every time an iteration of the doctor reaches its end? They consider that a death and they take that testimony?
I think the way I interpreted it was the fact that we had this strange instance where the doctor was contemplating death at two distinct intervals. Mm-hmm. And if they didn't interact with one another, they could have, and that was the paradox that they were concerned with, and that's what threw their system out of whack, was that they had this paradoxical moment where you had a past and a future iteration or future instance of the doctor both prepared to end.
Yeah.
If one ended, the other one shouldn't have existed. The other one prepared to end in the presence of the first, and that was the aberration or the error in the system as far as as they were having. So I don't think they were even taking into account the first doctor. I think they were concerned about, they were ready for the second doctor for the 12th doctor to call it quits. I mean, as far as I recognize it, I don't know. Their paths shouldn't necessarily have crossed as far as what the testimony was prepared for, but maybe again, this was the TARDIS stepping in. And that
it was the 12th doctor didn't expect to end up there. He just, I think the TARDIS was flying itself, wasn't it? I meant to go back and watch the end of series 10. But
he was not in control of the piloting at that point. Because he was breaking down. I mean, at that point he was barely able to remain upright, which is why he stumbled out into the snow. So this leads us to the fact that when we get to our regeneration point, that the TARDIS is in bad shape. Mm-hmm. And I know a lot of people that I've been reading have been having some issue with, I don't really understand, other than the fact that they wanted to give Chibnall's company a chance to come in, whether it be Bob Woodward their production designer to design yet another TARDIS interior. So they have to burn out the old one. But is there a justification for the fact that the entire console room explodes, throwing the doctor out into the London skyline?
You know, the theory that I've been kind of working on is it depends on how long the doctor has been holding regeneration energy in check, because the ninth doctor just kind of was like, oh, I'm regenerating, all right, good to go, and regenerates rather peacefully. Tennant, you know, holds on to it for like five episodes and blows up the TARDIS. Eleven burned a whole bunch of it up to destroy all the ships and whatnot, and then went and had a peaceful regeneration. Yeah. And 12 was holding it all in and blew up the TARDIS. So
and again, you had the two regenerations, 10 and 12, happening in the TARDIS in operation.
That's true, yeah.
So you've got, as first doctor refers to it, one of the most complicated devices in the history
space-time machines, time travel,
and you throw a power surge through it like that, it's already got janky navigation.
Now, the whole thing about the TARDIS trying to get rid of the 13th doctor, or her falling out anyway, there was a moment where you see the TARDIS from the outside, like pitched almost 90 degrees horizontally, and it looks like it's moving up and down, almost like shaking a ketchup bottle. Like, it almost seemed to me like the TARDIS was trying to eject her at that point.
Yeah, it's going to get really hot in here, so I'm going to throw you clear of the wreckage, all right? Just let go. But before this happens, we do get our first line. Deliver pure Yorkshire.
Which was kind of hard to understand.
Admit it. You have to. Go on record here.
Oh, yeah. No, I had to go back and like listen to it three or four times because I kept on hearing, Berlin. I knew that wasn't correct.
Next season opens with a doctor falling on the streets of Berlin.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean,
as the wall comes down. That would be very punk.
Oh, very punk.
Now, all right. One thing I wanted to bring up, though, was that when we get the 13th Doctor first showing up, like right after their generation blast, before everything starts going all crazy, there you can hear it clear as day, but they are playing the Bad Wolf theme.
Okay. We'll get our final mix and be able to try to isolate exactly where this cuts in, because there were a number of instances where Murray's orchestration was working in previous themes because you had all the recurring characters. Mm-hmm. So you had actual some of the scores from Into the Dalek when we get to Rusty's reveal. Obviously, when we find out about the Lethbridge-Stewart family lineage, the Brigadier song, which is near and dear to my heart, starts playing, and it's an unmistakable theme. Bill's theme, Clara's theme, I mean, they're all in there. Because of the chaos going on at the moment, post-regeneration and everything winding down in that mix, I'm going to have to listen to it again to hear exactly when those couple of chords from the Bad Wolf theme cut in. I want to say it's at the moment where she turns the monitor and sees her reflection superimposed, but I don't really know if there's any significance. There's always significance to it. This is Moffat, after all. He's a chess master. But yeah, what it could mean...
I had a friend who asked me, like, they literally sent me the question, like, what do you think that means? Or any speculations as to what that means? And I told her, I was like, you know, a possible meaning could be that the moment who, like, recognized herself as Bad Wolf or whatever, set some program in the TARDIS to, you know, if these circumstances ever happen during a regeneration, then do this, that, and the other. And, you know, maybe it's slings that, or more likely it's the fact that Murray Gold has returned to this theme a couple times throughout the show when he wants to kind of have that uncomfortable or ominous feeling for something where it's like you can tell there's something going on that's going to mean something, but you're not quite sure what. And also the fact that the Bad Wolf theme was one of the first things that Murray Gold reportedly wrote for Doctor Who. And to have that be the thing that you hear as he's leaving the show, just, I mean, it makes sense that
That's very true. I hadn't even considered that because I didn't know chronologically if that was one of the first pieces that he actually scored. But that would be a nice closure because that was not only one of the first pieces, but one of the first really recognizable, iconic compositions that wasn't his variation on the opening theme, mm-hmm. you know, but his own piece that was just, you know, every time you heard it, you knew what was occurring. Because otherwise, trying to shoehorn in the whole idea of, all right, well, this is a manifestation of the time vortex, or maybe it's got some Rose Tyler linked in there, but you could make your head hurt with all the what ifs. But something like that, that's kind of like more of an Occam's razor kind of solution that I'd be, I could sleep a lot better knowing that were the solution to it.
I'm not going to put out a whole lot of, I'm not going to cram a whole lot of thought into trying to figure out what it means. It's just, I think it's a nice similarity to the entrance to a show.
Yeah. But to close this on what we can now kind of consider for the 13th, I think I think the fact that this is one of those instances where you know how some regenerations are a little clunkier than others. You know, either you're going through a real physical upheaval, or it's complete mental shutdown. You got to go into the Zed room for who knows how long, or what have you. Or you're completely, you know, apoplectic for who knows how long. In this instance, the recognition is there, the cognizance, the placement of where she is at that moment is quite clear, and mm-hmm. and the grin that breaks when she realizes the opportunity that she has right now is a culmination of all of the hope and expectations that so much of the fan base has going forward. It's not going to make the wait any shorter. Sorry, kids, it's just not. If anything, it's just gonna, you know, go give you a few more things you're gonna have to chew on while you're waiting. But I think it just assures me that Whitaker is gonna go at this with absolutely every piston firing. She's so excited to do this, and the line that they gave her to use, even though it's kind of smacks of Tennant a little bit, but just the same, Tennant brought a new era of real whimsy to the character. You know, he made it really kind of off the wall again. From what we had expected from Eccleston, not to say that he was, you know, anything kind of stodgy or stiff, but it completely flipped the game.
Yeah.
It was the first time modern Whovians had seen a change of your title character, and it was a change of persona, and what do you do with it? And, you know, Christmas Invasion, it was just bizarre. I mean, we didn't know what to expect from this guy. We get that surprise all over again, and I'm really, really looking forward.
Yeah, it's, I'm, as much as I hate to see Capaldi go, I can't wait to see what Whitaker brings to the role. I think that this is going to be a fantastic run.
Haley, anything else you were able to grasp from the 12 and a half seconds we got with Jody?
I mean, you're never happy to see a doctor go, but I think this is the first time I've ever been almost okay with it at the time that it happened.
Yeah.
Because I'm just so excited to see what they're going to do with Jody. Mm.
And how she's going to land, because it's going to be tough.
I don't know. She could use that coat maybe as like a parachute.
I don't know. That it's got a lot of holes in it right now. Like a lot.
That's true.
That's true.
Although, what did he say? Something about his impeccable fashion sense? What was that exchange? I really loved that one where she was saying, you know what? Or
Why is it so hard to give the doctor up or something? Yeah, he said it's his impeccable fashion sense.
Right. I have to say, my superior intelligence? No. Yes. My dazzling charisma. My impeccable dress sense. Yeah. Just enough ego to go around. But yeah.
I did like the fact that the doctor was back into his thin white Duke outfit. The first outfit that we saw him in. Because, I mean, he went through a lot of different outfits.
Yep.
So it was kind of fun to see him actually back in the
original. With all the battle scars all over it, too. I thought that was a nice little added touch. And his hair just insane. The Mad Floof had ever gotten. The fact that Jodie Whittaker's got shorter hair than Peter Capaldi. Insane. Insane.
Did it get longer as the episode went on?
I think so.
I think it did. It was actively growing.
All right. Well, there, I could go on another technical stuff through the rain, whatever, but that was really kind of special and a great point to kind of halt there. I didn't think there was going to be any news. I figured at this point,
we were content to just roll with what it was on.
Yeah. But then you realize after the credits roll and you get to see and introducing Jodie Whittaker as the doctor and everything goes on, you realize, oh, wait, there's a real world out there too. Sort of. Still related to our Whovian scope here, but it has to do with all the conventions.
From Con World.
Yeah, the Con World. Good news, bad news, I guess you could say. But we'll make sure that we address kind of the bad news here first. And that is that for the foreseeable future, we never say never again, and you only live twice, and other Bond aphorisms. Long Island Doctor Who, the convention, is going to be postponing any iteration of L.I. Who 6 until further notice. Showrunner Ken Deep, who we've had on the show numerous occasions, had issued a blog post about it, saying it was a matter of finances, and they're not closing the books. They're still going to be looking for the opportunity to be able to bring the convention back at full strength when they have the means to. But 2018 will not be the year to see that happen. So that was one of the reasons why people were kind of wondering why they weren't doing the early bird purchases at the close of L.I. Who 5. I was wondering, but kind of official at this point. So so kind of pour a 40 out of the curb for that one, I suppose, for the time being. But it might free us up. Who knows? Maybe now in November we've got Chicago TARDIS on the horizon.
Yeah, maybe Chicago TARDIS will go a couple weeks earlier instead of having it on Thanksgiving weekend.
Yeah. Well, you know, they've been doing this for decades.
You'd
think they'd... Well, anyway. But on the good news side, still related to cons, is that the fact that that over in Baltimore, Oni and James have been continuing to build the lineup for what will be the fourth iteration of Regeneration Who. If you have the opportunity to come out to the East Coast in March instead of November, I do hope that you do. It's the weekend of the 23rd, 24th, 25th of 2018, right smack on the harbor in Baltimore. It's a beautiful little location. It's a great little hotel. Well, I shouldn't say little. It's a fairly big hotel, but it feels small because you are rubbing elbows over the entire weekend with a massive lineup that just got a lot bigger over the course of the last week or two. Multiple doctors there. You'll have your fifth doctor, your sixth doctor. You will have Missy, Rachel Talalay will be there again, and can't wait to hear from her about all the things that she's got to say about the close of her work on Twice Upon a Time and just her legacy working with Stephen and with Peter. And then the list just begins. I mean, as far as classic companions, Carol Ann Ford will be there. William Russell, finally, we get a chance to hang out with Ian Chesterton for a little while. Nicola Bryant is back. My girl.
Sarah Sutton as well.
Sarah Sutton, Nyssa. This is a great opportunity. I mean, for people that got a chance to come to Elihu 5 and hear Lala Ward discuss her years with Romana, now you get Sarah Sutton for Nyssa, which pairs up really nicely at the fact that we've recently had Janet Fielding coming around, so you've got that whole... This just keeps building. Adric, Matthew Waterhouse is going to be there. It's good. Come on. This is just getting better and better. And it goes on and on and on. And I got really, really excited about 2 weeks back when they announced the fact that Michael Jaston was going to be there. The Valyard.
Yes.
The man I would just love to see back on screen again in Doctor Who. Even if they didn't give him his character, just have him as a walk-on, and everyone would go, ooh, I never recognize him without the creepy black helmet on. You know? And we go on and on and on. So if you've got the opportunity, please consider it. Flights to Baltimore from anywhere up and down the East Coast are pretty darn cheap. I will say that. In fact, I've learned it's probably going to be cheaper for me to fly from Connecticut to Baltimore than it is to drive because the tolls are insane going up and down the turnpike. It's like $40 each way in tolls I was paying. Taken wrong turns. But yeah, anyway, so some really good stuff to look forward to in that regard. And it's only months and months away. So you get over galley, you come back, you recover, sober up a little bit, maybe get a liver transplant, sell some blood so that you can get some pocket money back, and then come to Baltimore and blow it all again.
Yay.
Works out real well.
As Haley could say, what could possibly go wrong?
Yeah.
There you go. What are we doing now? Crap! We're back under a hiatus.
Yeah.
What the hell are we talking about?
It was a nice break, wasn't it? When we record next week, it'll actually be our first podcast of 2018. So, as we like to do towards the end of the year, we get nostalgic, and so we're going to take a look back at 2017 as a year in Doctor Who. We'll try and ignore most of the rest of the stuff that happened. Yeah. Just see what this year has brought us in the world of Doctor Who.
Yeah, yeah. And a long list it'll be. We'll have to kind of prioritize a little bit or else it'll end up being an uncomfortably long cast. So yeah. We're sparing all of you. Thank us now. And we'll just sing, you're welcome, you're welcome.
All right. Well, this has been episode 265 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Jay saying, when you're already dying, you're entitled to think that your day couldn't get any worse. But here you are.
This is Kira saying, funny how things work out.
And this is Haley saying, I hope we talk about it loads. I hope we spend years laughing about it.
Well chosen.
We'll see you guys next week.
Allons-y.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. We love getting feedback from listeners, so don't hesitate to share your thoughts with us. You can email us at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com, tell us on Twitter @GallifreyRadio, or on Facebook @facebook.com/GallifreyPublicRadio. You can also leave us a voicemail for inclusion in future shows at 210-802-1477. That's 210-802-1GPR. You should also go to GunnaGeek.com and check out lots of other high-quality geek-centric shows, or visit forums.gunnageek.com to talk about anything geeky with us or the community.
Haley, you want to cough anything into a nearby fancy hanky first?
All right, there. Feels good.
Good.
All good to go.
You really need to start keeping whiskey nearby. I have yet to find anything related to the podcasting field that can't be corrected by a good shot of whiskey.
I mean, it's not going to stop your coughing, but it'll make it far more enjoyable.
Come on. What?
I just won't care that I'm coughing anymore.
In the pantheon of what could go wrong that we've established over the course of the years.